Live from the launching pad in Sedona, Arizona, it's Vortex Network News. I'm your host, Aurora Light. I'm here today with William Alec, my co-producer.
Good morning, Aurora.
Thank you for being with me today, Bill.
It's my pleasure.
It's a beautiful day in Sedona.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yes, it is.
It's lovely. Yeah, so we're going to be talking about our a subject we've been handling for the last few weeks, looking into, delving into, and sharing our information with the listening audience. And I want to say hello and welcome to all the listeners out there in the U.S. and parts abroad. We are very happy that you're joining us today, and we want to bring to you the latest information that you're not going to get most places. And today we're going to be talking with John Moore, who is an expert on global warming, as well as other things that the government is not telling you about. And he is our guest today. And I want to welcome him to our show. Hello, John. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Aurora. Hello, Bill. And it's a beautiful high noon day here in deep in the mountains of the Missouri Ozarks.
All right. Well, we're both in the mountains here. It's pretty nice, isn't it? Very pristine. Well, thank you for joining us today. You know, this is something that has just come to my attention recently, is the Wormwood theory and Planet X theory as being something that is really a viable reality. And I'm wondering, what is your feelings on the subject?
Well, I've spent a lot of time on this, Aurora, going back to two friends of mine who are both researchers independently without telling each other. They approached me in 2001, I believe it was, and told me about this event that would be happening in the future due to a planetary-sized object coming into our solar system. At the time, I thought, well, these guys need tinfoil hats real bad. It sounds pretty silly. But I know they're both to be serious men and serious researchers, so I approached another friend of mine who has, shall we say, privileged access to certain lettered agencies. And I told him about this, and he basically thought the same thing about me, that I needed a tinfoil hat real bad. But he's known me for years. We've been friends for 25 years now, and he made some inquiries, got back with me 3 or 4 weeks later, and he says, John, it's exactly what you said it is. The federal government found out about this in 1979 with the Pioneer 10 space probe, and they've been aware of it and tracking it and getting ready by building very expensive underground shelters since 1979, 1980. Well, once I got that confirmation, I began my study in earnest. And
when you got that message, first of all, when that was conveyed to you, were you a little stunned by it?
Well, I was stunned in one hand, but on the other, it didn't surprise me that the government would keep stuff from us. As a very young man, I was in military intelligence school when I was 19 years old and went to Vietnam 2 years after my 20th birthday. So I had privileged access then. I attended a secret briefing at the Tactical Operations Center every morning, Monday through Friday. And it didn't take me 4 weeks of being in Vietnam that I knew for a fact that the war everybody thought was happening in Vietnam and back here in the States was not the war I was fighting. It was two different wars. So that was my entree as an adult, too.
And now that you've opened up that can of worms, you just briefly comment on what was the difference between the two.
The religious aspects of it, the fact that the Catholicism had played a massive role in everything we were doing right and everything we were doing wrong.
Really? I never heard that connection before.
Well, one of my jobs was to study the Vietnamese history and culture going back centuries, but French Catholic missionaries showed up in Vietnam in the 1860s, and there was a percentage of the population of the native Vietnamese people who converted to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did so, French invaders, colonialists, held out positions of trust and responsibility and wealth to people who would make that conversion to Catholicism. And that was in the 1860s. By the time we were there in the 1960s, the people who had the Catholic faith, Vietnamese who were Catholics, held almost every position in government that amounted to anything. I can give you a couple of clear examples. There was only one general in the entire Vietnamese army, only one general who was not Catholic. And they had hundreds of generals.
Wow.
And almost all the Viet Cong were Buddhists. And there were probably very few, if any, Catholic Viet Cong. Most of the soldiers being drafted were Buddhists. This rift between Catholicism and Buddhism was a huge part of why the Republic of Vietnam could not win the trust and support of 90% of the people, because 90% of the people were Buddhist and 10% were Catholic. So if you're Buddhist in Vietnam, you know that you're never going to have any kind of position in government worth a damn.
If you want to have a government career. Well,
you're being taxed. All the taxes are going to support mostly Catholics.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I did not realize there was a religious connotation to the war.
Absolutely. It was one of the major factors in everything we did there.
Wow, it's the first I've heard of that. Wow, you got a book there in your head, don't you? Well, getting back on to the topic, and I want to thank you for sharing that with us, because it's a bit of information I don't think any of our listeners have heard before. So you're approaching some of your buddies who are in high levels, and they're confirming that this is a reality at this point.
Right.
And now it's really getting your attention, correct?
It is, and I'm doing my research and reading books. I've probably read between 5,000 and 6,000 pages of various books on archaeology and astronomy and human history going back thousands of years. And then in the summer of 2005, I'm having lunch with another friend I served with in the Army, U.S. Army Special Forces. He left the Army, went into the Navy, and retired as a Navy SEAL. And during that lunch, I'm bringing up this topic of the 10th planet. And he brings up a topic of a secret briefing that he went to while he was in the Navy. Now, what the Navy told these men, and since this one debrief, I've since debriefed more than 24 of these retired Navy submarine veterans. They were told, gentlemen, in your lifetimes, not your children's, not your grandchildren's, within your lifetimes, these oceans are going to come out of their basins and flood all low-lying areas 400 feet above sea level and lower on all the continents, North America, South America, Asia, Europe, Africa, wiping out basically the infrastructure that supports 50 to 75% of the humans living on this planet, because that's where they live, is within 100 miles of these oceans. And they also said, gentlemen, one of the known safe havens is the Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks. It turns out, Aurora, that every veteran I talked to was actually at the briefing, got the full briefing. When they retired, they moved to the Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks. And one of them, thank goodness, one of them has agreed to go public with me, Mr. Tim Spencer. I've interviewed him on my radio show several times, and he's agreed, and we've already videotaped an interview that I'll be publishing here hopefully in the next month or two of him talking about his experience and about the classified map that he saw while he was in the U.S. Navy. The classified map, which by the way is on my DVD, Global Warming, What the Government Isn't Telling You. All these men were shown this map. It shows North America with new coastlines, East Coast, West Coast, Gulf Coast, and the Mississippi River Valley being inundated by 100 or more feet of water, mm-hmm. up to 400 feet above sea level. The Navy says up to 400 feet above sea level is at risk of being wiped out on the East Coast, West Coast, and Gulf Coast.
Haven't they started moving some of their bases
to
Denver area and stuff?
Yes, and as you and Bill know, Aurora, I'm a homicide detective. I worked my first murder case the fall of 1973. I have two homicides in my case inventory right now, and I know about evidence, and there's something called circumstantial evidence. And when it comes to this topic, here's the circumstantial, or what you might call secondary evidence. I'm going to give out some simple Google searches here, Aurora, that anybody can do these Google searches, and they can find the government press releases talking about what you and I are talking about right now. Here's the first one. CIA and the word Denver. That's the first Google search. CIA and the word Denver. And you'll find the CIA's press releases going back to 2005 that they're relocating from Langley, Virginia on the East Coast about 85, 90 feet above sea level to the Mile High City in the middle of the continent. Next Google search, NSA, as in no such agency, National Security Agency, and the word Denver, and the word Utah, and the word Augusta, Georgia. NSA is relocating to several places away from Fort Meade, Maryland, very near the East Coast, and just 100 or 200 feet above sea level. Next Google search. And before I do this, now, Bill, are you there?
Yes. Yes, I am.
You're being very quiet, but I'm going to ask you a question, Bill.
Well, I'm listening intently.
If you and I were scientists, Bill, mm-hmm. and researchers, and we were going to study really fun stuff like foot and mouth disease and anthrax, mm-hmm. wouldn't it be a smart mm-hmm. thing for us to put our buildings on an island in the Atlantic Ocean? Would that be a smart thing to do?
Well, not if the seas are going to be shifting about.
Well, play along with me here. It would be a smart thing to do. And 50 years ago, that's what they did. They built the Plum Island Animal Research Facility. The federal government did this on Plum Island, about 100 miles out in the Atlantic from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
It's over 200 acres. And if you do a Google search, a Google image search, you can find both topographical maps and aerial photographs of Plum Island. And the reason they say they're moving to Kansas, and this is your Google search, Plum Island and the word Kansas. They're moving this very dangerous facility from a fairly safe place on an island in the Atlantic Ocean to the mm-hmm. most productive agricultural real estate on the planet, Kansas. You know, there's hardly a square foot of Kansas that doesn't grow something. But that's where they're moving it to. And the reason they give, get this, ladies and gentlemen, the reason they say they're moving it is, oh, we've run out of space on Plum Island.
Well, if this wormwood, Planet X, whatever you want to call it, what do you call it?
I usually call it Planet X. It has about 20 different names.
Well, wormwood, doesn't that tie into the revelations of the Bible?
Wormwood is mentioned in the Bible, correct. That's the biblical name for it. It's also called the Destroyer. It's got a number of names.
Okay, so...
I usually call it... Planet X can mean two different things. X can mean... astronomical terms, it means an unknown planet, and it could also mean the 10th planet.
Okay.
I usually refer to it either as the 10th planet or Planet X.
Mm-hmm.
I use the terms interchangeably.
We're in the habit of calling it wormwood to tie in for a lot of people who are into Revelation.
Well, I don't have any problem with that.
Like Bill and I kind of tie it into that, you know, because those seven seals and the prophecies and revelations are kind of like signposts for us to pay attention
right.
to.
Precisely. Yeah, well, the words are all synonyms, and I mm-hmm. whatever, you know, wormwood's fire.
Okay, so I just want to clarify for our listeners that we're talking about the same thing.
Absolutely. Well, the publicly stated reason for moving this animal research facility is, quote-unquote, we've run out of space on Plum Island. You can look at the aerial photographs and topographical maps. You can see that 200 acres is a lot of space for a lot of buildings, but they've only got a few there, and there's many, many acres of green grass left over. Well, that's obviously a cover story and obviously deceptive. They're moving it because they have no choice. That's why they're moving it.
Right, because when this wormwood comes through, the seas are going to be very rough indeed. I mean, it's going to be like a tsunami, correct?
Right. Well, a tsunami, a tidal wave, yes.
Yeah.
Plum Island will be underwater. That's basically the bottom line.
Right.
Next Google search. EPA, as in Environmental Protection Agency, EPA and the word libraries, plural. EPA and the word libraries, plural. Now, up until three summers ago, the EPA had four libraries. It's the largest English language collection of cross-reference scientific articles and journals on the topics that their scientists need to keep us safe. Now, the publicly stated reason was, well, we need to do this to save money. Now, Bill, I'm going to ask you, is filing a grievance against your employer, is that sort of like suing your boss? Well, it is, isn't it?
Well,
it's
yes,
not really
yes,
career,
absolutely.
It's not really career enhancing, is it?
No.
No, of course not.
Not very.
Obviously not. The scientists at the EPA, they filed grievances against their employer. Ladies and gentlemen, the scientists sued their bosses, saying, gentlemen, you've cut us off from the basic research material we need to keep America safe. And, of course, the response was, we're shutting these libraries down to save money. And then, thank goodness, there's one honest lettered agency, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office. They come back and say, no, gentlemen, it costs more to shut down these four libraries than to keep them open.
Wow.
Now, they're not going to put at risk that priceless collection of scientific material. Those libraries were shut for a reason, and we already know, because the GAO told us so, that it's not the publicly stated reason to save money, because it costs more money to shut it down than keep them open. They shut it down for another reason. My opinion, based on what I know, is they shut it down so they could move all four of those libraries to safe havens where they'll be safe.
Mm-hmm.
The same summer, here's your next Google search. The word Vatican and the word library. The Vatican Library, which has been open for six centuries, every working day for six centuries, was closed 3 years ago. The alleged reason given, the publicly stated reason, was we have a structural problem in the main building and we need to shut down the library, repair it, and then we'll open it up after it's all fixed. Well, Now that collection is the largest collection of ancient manuscripts on the planet that we're aware of.
Mm-hmm.
It is priceless. It is irreplaceable.
Stolen from the best places.
Yeah. Well, yes. There's some evidence that when the Roman army burned the library at Alexandria, Egypt, ancient library. Okay, there's some evidence that what they burned were a bunch of old tax records and stuff nobody cared about. And they took back to Rome the books on engineering, science, medicine, and so forth.
That makes sense.
The Romans weren't stupid. They were,
no.
You know, they would not burn the good stuff.
No.
And then when the Roman government was falling apart around 400 AD, the Catholic Church took custody of all that material, and they've had it ever since.
That's right. That sounds likely.
Well, that's very likely, and that would be consistent with the way human beings and organizations work. I got a lawnmower working past me here, and I need to close my window.
Now, do you think that they moved the library?
No, they took. Now, what are you talking about with the library?
The Vatican Library.
Yeah, the Vatican Library.
They probably moved it to either the Swiss Alps or the Rocky Mountains, one or the other. Most likely, that's what they did with it.
Hmm.
Yeah, but these are simple Google searches that anybody can do to find the what we might call secondary or circumstantial evidence that important, very large entities are doing things and doing them right now. Now, the next Google search is fairly well known, and that's the seed, as in tomato seed, garden seed, potato seed, the seed vault built at the edge of the Arctic Circle.
Yes, that's been getting a lot of publicity.
On an island. Now, I was looking at this just this morning on a map of the world, this island. It's part of Norway, but it's not part of the continent. It's an island several hundred miles from the mainland. Bill Gates helped provide some of the funding for this. Now, logistics is something that plays into this seed vault. Yeah. Now, Bill, if you're going to put in, say, a 20 by 20 foot patio, concrete patio in your backyard, you set up your farms and you call a ready mix truck, right?
Right.
If you're on an island near the Arctic Circle and you're building a huge steel reinforced concrete commercial structure like this, there's no ready mix plant to call up. They did this in 9 months. They built a huge commercial steel reinforced structure at the edge of the Arctic Circle. They had to bring in everything. They had to set up their own ready mix plant. They had to provide housing, food, shelter, and housing, food, and shelter for all their employees that worked there. And they got this done in 9 months.
It's amazing. Probably they can't even do a 1 mile of road here in Sedona in 9 months.
Well, what I'm saying is to pull that off, to have that kind of effort.
That's amazing.
To do that in 9 months means a tremendous, they were probably had two shifts working 16 hours a day.
It would have to be something like that.
Well, most likely. Most likely to pull that off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bill Gates is a lot of things, but he's no fool. And there's other seed vaults around the planet, by the way. Every major country has a similar type facility, a seed vault. But this is the biggest and best. And they built this because they need it. And they were in a hurry because they need it now, not 10 years in the future. Now, Bill and Aurora, have either one of you watched Al Gore's film, The Inconvenient Truth?
Yes, we have.
Okay. If you watch it, I might want to suggest everybody maybe consider watching it again. Don't buy it, but get a copy from the library.
Yeah.
And here's one thing I'm going to ask you to watch for and look for, and that's the timeline. Now, the timeline that Al Gore gives is not something that he dreamed up and pulled out of his hat. It's the same timeline put out by NASA. Now, NASA is the lead government agency when it comes to global warming and earth changes and all that. And here's a timeline he gives, and he doesn't give a year. What he says is 10 years in the future. Now, the film came out in, 2006.
Okay.
The spring of 2006.
Right.
He says 10 years in the future, things will start to get bad, rising ocean levels, abrupt climate change. And in the middle of the century, which obviously would be 2050, in the middle of the century, they will really be bad. Abrupt climate change and rising ocean levels and so forth. Now, that's the official government timeline, not Al Gore's. And that's an absolute lie, ladies and gentlemen. Mm-hmm. That's a lie. Now, I can give you one date that I know for a fact it's already passed. The date the federal government gave themselves to get most of their preparations complete. That was December 2009. Originally, their completion date was December 2010. Going back to about 05 or 06, it was about 05, I guess it was. They moved the date closer to us in time by one full calendar year. They came to understand we don't have until December 2010. We need to get this done by December 2009, and that's to complete their continuity of government contingency plans.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to the National Security Agency for a moment. This is fascinating. There was a film, a Gene Hackman film, Enemy of the State,
mm-hmm.
with
yeah.
Will Smith. Okay. There is a line in there that Hackman gives, which is a reflection of reality. In fact, at Fort Meade, Maryland, the NSA has 18 acres of Cray mainframe computers underground with about a 6 or 8 foot walk space between them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they have. They're duplicating that. They're shutting down what they got at Fort Meade, Maryland, where they've always been, by the way, and they're moving to a new facility 20 miles south of Salt Lake City in the desert. Now, I lived 20 miles south of Salt Lake City in the desert for a month with the Army at Tooele, Utah, and I can tell you, Aurora, it really is the desert.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I mean, I got to walk home. I got stuck and missed the bus one night. I had to walk through the desert in a sandstorm.
Mm-hmm.
I was walking backwards. To get where I was going, I walked backwards to keep the sand out of my nose and eyes, leaning at about I wasn't quite vertical. I had to lean into the wind to be able to just, you know, keep going against the, yeah, that's the desert. And here's the reason they say. Now, before I go into this, now, Bill, you may or may not be aware of this, but the National Power Grid for about 20 years or so has been able to sell electricity back and forth across the country to each other. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
Okay. Aurora, were you aware of that?
No, I really didn't know that we had to shift it around like that.
Well, we can. It's become a tradable commodity.
Okay.
Electricity is now a tradable commodity between the various power companies.
All right.
So keep that thought in mind. Now, they need a reason to move from Fort Meade, Maryland. And here's the reason they state. Our local power company can no longer provide us with enough electricity. Oh, yeah. Now, I'm a businessman, and any businessman will tell you this. if my customer wants more of my product, I will do whatever it takes to get it to them. Because mm-hmm. that's what I'm in business for.
Yeah.
Provide what my customer needs.
Right.
Whether it's tennis shoes or golf clubs or electricity. If my customer wants more golf clubs, by goodness gracious, I'm going to get them more golf clubs. If my customer wants more electricity, I'll figure out a way to get it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's obviously a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
The publicly stated reason for the CII moving to Denver, this is a hoot. Original press releases, going back to 05, I don't know if it's still archived on Google or not, but the original ones were so funny that they got tired of people laughing at them, and they changed it. But I'll tell you both, the original and the current one. The original reason for moving from Langley, Virginia to Denver by the CIA was, quote, unquote, we want to break up the good old boy network that's been in place for so many decades.
Oh, my goodness. That's really strange.
I know. Yeah. And it is a stretch. Now, they changed that after it took nearly a year of being laughed at. Now they just say, quote, unquote, for operational reasons.
Now, you know,
my friends inside the CIA, Rora, they say, John, they're not even telling us why we're moving.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, have you ever heard that the Denver airport is a very strange, bizarre place?
Well, there is, and Jesse Ventura exposed that publicly.
Now, you know, that Pandora's Box, the original video that Jesse Ventura, you know, did the spinoff on?
Right.
Pandora's
right.
Box
well,
was incredible. I suggest our listening audience check out Pandora's Box. We're going to see if, you know, we can get her back on our show. I used to interview her about this, but they depict there in Denver Airport massive death in murals. What is that? I mean, where did something like that ever come from?
You're right, Aurora, and I was kind of disappointed that Jesse had the opportunity and the financial wherewithal to do the following. What needed to be done was to interview the artist. Now, the artist who did those murals was given parameters by the people that hired him as to what they wanted
exactly.
that mural to depict.
Exactly.
You know, what Jesse did was stand there in front of it like some tourist and comment on the images he saw. That's not journalism.
No, it's not.
Any high school kid can do that. You need to contact the artist, and there's going to be a written contract. That artist had a written contract from his employer saying, we want a mural to depict the following. That's
exactly.
what the interview should have been.
Exactly.
That's what the interview should have been. And I was disappointed that it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I hear that it's a gigantic coffin moving operation. They have it set up so that they can handle large masses of coffins. Of course, coffins.
At the Denver Airport.
Yeah.
At the Denver Airport.
Yes. That is.
Well, I don't know about
that's
that.
That's in the Pandora's Box DVD that people can check out. She did a lot of research. The lady who did that, but you're right. I mean, who gave the order to create murals in the Denver Airport of devastation and sorrow and death?
Right. Right. Well, those images are very disturbing and very realistic.
Oh yeah.
Realistic symbology, I guess you could say. But it's not the kind of thing to give people warm and fuzzy feelings before they get inside a metal tube and go 400 miles an hour. You know?
Exactly. Now, I want to ask you something else. Do you think that the location of the Denver airport is odd with it?
Well, first of all, Denver did not need a new airport.
Exactly.
The place they chose to build it was not a very good site as far as wind and weather is concerned. And they moved enough dirt to build a new Panama Canal. Jesse Ventura touched on that. There's all kinds of compartmentalization and secrecy about the things that went on building it and continue to go on.
Well, we're going to take a short break here, and John, and when we get back, we're going to pick up here as to what the government has been doing for this preparation and what you can do, those of you listening, to prepare for what's coming up next here on our planet.
Stay tuned. Here with John Monroe talking about John Moore, excuse me. No, thanks. See, that's what happens when I don't have my visuals. I become Looney Tunes. This subject has really got me in its grip. You know, I think of it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about, the evidence for it and how we can impress our listeners, as well as myself, with evidence that supports these theories. So I want to backtrack a little bit, if I may, John, to, when they've been carbon dating or when they've been going through the poles, the ice in the poles, the layers, I've heard that they've found some red cosmic dust that would only be able to occur during very unusual circumstances in the dirt and in the ice. Can you talk a little bit about that? I'm not an expert on it.
There's some really hard evidence to back up what you're saying. There was a scientist, he was a medical doctor by his formal training, who back in the 1950s and 60s wrote several books on these related topics. His name was Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky. One of the things that Dr. Velikovsky did that nobody had ever bothered to do before was reconcile ancient calendars. Now, the ancient Egyptians had calendars, the Mayans had calendars, the ancient Chinese had calendars, the people that lived in West Northern Scandinavia all had calendars, and other cultures across the planet had calendars 3,000-5,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. The Hebrews had their calendar. What none of these archaeologists had ever done, because it's just the nature of professional people. The people that study the Mayans never talked to the people that studied the ancient Chinese, and neither of them talked to the ones that studied ancient Egypt. What Velikovsky did was line up and reconcile these ancient calendars. And when he did, he found the following. Now, let's go for I'll use some examples that most people are familiar with. In the book of Exodus, when Moses is getting ready to leave Egypt, the River Nile turned red, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Okay. Well, once Velikovsky reconciled the calendars of South America, Asia, and Northern Europe with the Hebrew calendar and the Egyptian calendar, it was, oh my goodness. There was written records, by the way. All these cultures left written records. The water on the entire planet turned red at the same time the River Nile turned red.
Hmm.
And the reason for that was our planet was going through a massive cloud of red dust. That's why all the water on the planet turned red at the same time.
Right.
Okay, so we're walking around the desert. You and I and Moses, and we're kind of lost for 40 years, and two generations.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this stuff on the ground we can pick up and eat every morning. Manna from heaven. It's in the Bible, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, once you reconcile the calendars, you find the written records from South America, from Asia, from Northern Europe, that the same looking stuff, the same tasting stuff, was on the ground every morning at the same time on this planet.
Now, do you think that that was extraterrestrially dropped off?
No. What we think it was hydrocarbons in the atmosphere. And when the sun came up in the morning, it condensed, became a solid. The liquid became a solid. It fell on the ground. You could pick it up and eat it.
Now, run that by me again. I didn't quite catch that.
Okay. Okay. You have a pot of stuff boiling on the stove.
All right.
A liquid.
Okay.
It goes up in the air.
Yeah, it becomes
as a vapor. When it hits your cool ceiling above your stove,
yeah.
It condenses and becomes a liquid.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It falls back down like a raindrop.
Same principle, and it falls back down.
Mm-hmm.
And when this planet, our Earth was going through a cloud that had not only red dust in it, but later on it had the hydrocarbons. And, of course, hydrocarbons in the right form is something you can eat. And that's what we believe it was. We don't believe, you know, the scientists that I work with and study, we're not looking at any aliens or anything like that to be responsible for it. It's just a simple matter of science and what was going on at that point in time because of the part of space, what was happening in space at that time with the 10th planet and the hydrocarbons. Anyway.
Well, you know, I like to think that we have some friends upstairs who care about us. Do you think that that's a possibility?
Well, in your
clearing of all these top secret information people, do you have any of them ever convey to you that there are human appearing extraterrestrials?
Well, here's something I got this. Not in my, I have a studio office, but 100 feet from where I am in my living room, I've got a book that's a standard training manual used by firefighters all over the United States.
I have the same book, the Official Fire Guide.
Yeah, and it tells what to do if you come across a UFO spacecraft.
Right.
It says don't get between it and the ground. You're going to get radiated.
Well, that's the gray ships. The gray ships have high radiation. That's why they can't reproduce, and you know they're abducting people all the time for their DNA and all that.
Well, that's what more that's not a secret. Not class. This is a mainstream publication that basically every firehouse in the country has on their library shelf.
That's right. Now, you know, did you know that the Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy in Denver, is what I meant to say. They issued to their cadets that in their third year a publication that said very clearly that there are different types of extraterrestrials you may encounter and that we have encountered.
Right.
And then it had drawings of them and their body types and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when Bill's place was broken into when I moved in with him in Prescott about three years ago now, and they stole that book and some of the other books off my shelf. The Air Force Cadet.
Well, I've been investigating burglaries since 1973, and Aurora, I've never investigated a burglary where any book was taken ever.
Well, they
by
came
agents.
In. They, Bill, we came back from the X conference in Washington, and we walk in and all these fabulous books, they helped themselves to what they wanted. About 25 of them, I would say, went out the door.
Really?
Yeah. That's unbelievable. So, you know, this is what we have, that we're facing here is massive amounts of suppression of truth. And
absolutely.
Why is that? Why are they so afraid that if they tell us the truth? Well, I guess it's like the herd mentality. They're afraid that, you know, they got to put away enough for them, and they know they can't put away enough for everybody.
Well, there's different aspects of this, Aurora, and you touched on one of them. But I think a big part of the fear of the powers that be is that I refer to myself and everybody, all the normal people like you, Aurora, and Bill, I refer to us as barefoot peasants.
Oh, yeah.
They're afraid that us barefoot peasants will find out our true power and our true history as human beings living on this planet. Because once we figure out how much power and what we can really do, which real essentially have no limits, then we don't need them anymore.
Oh yeah,
and their power goes away.
Well, somehow, it's like the dog is wagging. Instead of the dog wagging the tail, it's the tail wagging the dog. It's been this. We've let our politicians run amok. And we've got the government. Thank God we don't have the government we pay for.
They just make it up as they go along.
I agree.
Getting back to evidence. Okay. So some of these excavations that these geologists have done have indicated that there's this red cosmic dust.
Right.
And this red cosmic dust, it is presumed, is from the debris, the magnetic pull of this. Let's talk about this binary twin of our sun. Let's get people.
Right. Well, I'm going to recommend a DVD that people can get. I keep a small inventory. It's not my DVD, but I keep a few of them and I sell them on my website. Now we're going to talk about stars, right? Have planetary bodies, and when you're doing this, and this is not for entertainment purposes. We're talking about something of a most serious nature.
Yes,
now,
we are.
We're going to, and people want to hear about credentials. Now, my credentials, I'm a homicide detective. I'm a radio talk show host. I have not and never will draw a paycheck for looking at stars. But let's talk about somebody who did. Now, let's talk about credentials for looking at stars and drawing a paycheck. How's this? Supervising astronomer of the United States Naval Observatory, Dr. Robert Harrington, being interviewed in his office at the United States Naval Observatory on video talking about the 10th planet.
What year was this?
Late 1980s, and Zachariah Sitchin was conducting the interview.
Okay.
This DVD can be purchased. The title of it is Are We Alone in the Universe?
Okay.
Now, if you're going to draw a paycheck for looking at stars,
yeah,
do you think there's any upward mobility past being the supervising astronomer of the United States Naval Observatory?
Probably not.
I don't think so. No, you're right, Aurora.
Why is it that the Navy is involved in astronomy instead of the Air Force?
Well, first of all, the Air Force has only existed for 63 years.
Okay.
Between World War II and Korea is when the Air Force came into existence. The Navy is the oldest branch of the military, and they've been in existence for more than 200 years.
I see.
The Navy is, because of the nature of what the Navy does, they've always been involved in cutting-edge technology.
It was probably for navigational purposes.
Right.
Right.
Navigation and the things that they've and communications. It was nice for the Army to have two-way radio communications, but it was imperative for the Navy to have two-way radio communications. The Army had all kinds of ways to communicate before radios, but the Navy didn't. Anyway, they've always been involved in technology going back to especially the early part of the 20th century. And during World War II, they were heavily involved in the Manhattan Project and other things at that time. And once they got that lead and that momentum, they never gave it up. So the Navy has always been involved in high technology and always will be.
Okay.
But, that's the U.S. Navy. And where are we going with this train of thought?
Well, I was just asking you why the astronomers are, associated with
rather than
the Air Force.
Well, the best way to answer this is to give you a quick Reader's Digest summary of Dr. Harrington in this interview. He described the 10th planet, giving its size 3 to 5 times the size of Earth, stating that it has a far larger iron and nickel core, which gives it a lot more bang for its buck in terms of gravity and magnetic effect. He shows its orbit, and the orbit is almost identical to the one Zachariah Sitchin has learned about from studying the ancient Babylonian clay tablets.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
That's interesting.
Now, for any doubting Thomas who says, oh, this is a bunch of hooey, I'll stand Dr. Harrington's credentials against anybody's credentials. Now, during that same period of time, and going back a couple of years earlier, in the early 1980s, there was a few mainstream press releases, an article by the New York Times talking about the 10th planet, and an article in one of the mainstream encyclopedias giving the size and location and orbit of the 10th planet. This was shortly after it was found. It was found in 1979 by the Pioneer 10 space probe, and there was some mainstream media coverage for 2-3 years, and then a complete blackout ever since.
Now, a blackout on what exactly are we talking
mainstream
about?
Mainstream news coverage.
On
legitimate
what?
Mainstream news. On the 10th planet, on Wormwood.
Okay. So you're saying that, because I remember hearing something, and when do you say that the information cutoff was again?
Early, around 82, 83 is when they cut it off from mainstream media.
92, right? Are you saying?
82
oh,
or 83.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So, isn't that when the underground facilities were they were going at it big time then?
Yes. And in fact, my hometown, St. Louis, they built one just outside St. Louis in the next county over. It was part of a military training area, about over 1,000 acres, that had been built originally in World War II as a munitions plant. And in the mid-50s, they took about 40 acres and built a factory there to make nuclear material for the Department of Defense or Department of Energy or both. And they shut that down in the late 60s. And about 1980, they announced a Superfund cleanup site at that 40 acres. A couple of years later, they announced that they were shutting down all 1,000 acres to clean up nuclear waste. And that's that was my first red flag, because my buddies and myself, we knew that there was nuclear material nearby in that 40 acres.
Yeah.
So, without the Army's knowledge, without the Army's consent, on our own, we took our own radiation detection equipment every time we went training in that 1,000 acres, because we wanted to have children that had arms and did not have flippers.
Right.
And we never found anything above natural background radiation, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all over every square foot of that 1,000
okay.
acres for years, for mm-hmm. years. So when I heard that, that's when I started my investigation, taking photographs at the main gate. At a federal job site, they keep all the names of the subcontractors posted on whiteboards about 6 inches tall with black letters about 4 feet long, of every subcontractor on the premises at the main gate. So I'd photograph them. I take other photographs of the premises. I took aerial photographs. I did Freedom of Information Act requests. I interviewed outside vendors that worked there, and I interviewed employees that worked for the Department of Energy.
Wow.
And that went on for 20 years.
Oh,
and
you know.
It was not something I did
okay,
every
so,
day, but I did that.
You know, I've had so many strange experiences in my life, I mean, you know, that have shown me a reality that few people have pieced together. What you're talking about fits in to my, outlook on the reality of the situation at hand. And, I've heard that our government, during the World War II, planted bombs all along our waterways, and that they could, blow. So if we were ever attacked, the excuse was, if we were ever attacked by any, outsiders who wanted to take over the United States, that they could blow them up when they arrived,
Uh-huh.
And, wondering, and have you ever heard of that being truth? And are those? I've heard those.
No,
they're all still there.
On one hand, Aurora. On one hand, I haven't. But on the other, if I was in charge of defending this country, that's what I would do.
Yeah, I hear they're up and down the Mississippi and everywhere.
I would. I would wire every bridge in the United States with explosives if I was in charge of defending the
And I heard they have done that as well. Tunnels,
right,
bridges,
right. Well,
so, all the waterways.
Fairly well known that it's fairly well known that the country of Switzerland has done that. Every bridge in the country in Switzerland is wired to be blown up.
Right. Okay. So now something like a wormwood comes through. And, you know, everything's going wacky. And what if those things start going off?
Well, if they're done professionally and properly, they should not go off spontaneously on their own.
Okay.
Even
if there's fires
Modern explosives properly handled are as safe as a jar of peanut butter. I mean, you know, they can't go off inadvertently or by mistake.
Okay.
If everything's done right.
I was wondering about that because I hear they're just everywhere, all around Florida and all over the place. Okay, next question I have for you. Next, we've got to go. You know what? We're at the end of the show already. I'm getting the high sign that it's like time to take a break here.
Well, we got
to
pick this up next hour.
We're going to pick up part two here on the Progressive Tech Hour, and Bill's going to chime in here with some of his observations and get your opinion on them.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Thank you so much for this outstanding hour.
We come back. I want to talk about the Black Knight when we come back.
Okay, sounds good. We're going to look forward to it. Okay, everybody, run and get your herbal teas and whatnot. We'll be right back.